This is Free Speech Radio News for Tuesday, May 14th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, the Associated Press calls actions by the Justice Department massive and unprecedented after federal officials obtained reporters' phone records, including from home lines and cell phones. Anti-poverty advocates push to protect food stamp funds as a Senate committee takes up the 2013 Farm Bill. And from L.A. to Chicago, labor groups and free press advocates warn of media consolidation and partisan influence in the potential takeover of the Tribune Company by the billionaire Koch brothers. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Nell Abram with FSRN Headlines. The commander of a small Syrian rebel militia, Khalid al-Hamad, admitted to Time magazine today that he is the man who appears in a video mutilating the corpse of a soldier and biting into one of his organs. The United Nations and Human Rights Watch both condemned the video. UN Human Rights Commissioner Navi Pillay described the act as truly atrocious and called for armed opposition groups to investigate. Under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court, degrading or violating the dignity of a dead body is a war crime. The advocacy group added that though the act is shocking, so is the obstruction by some Security Council members to referring the matter of Syria to the ICC, a move that the UNHCR says could help to deter human rights violations. The UN issued a 131-page report in February documenting war crimes on both sides, including massacres, torture, sexual violence, and abuse of children. Supporters of the political party Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf, or PTI, held rallies and sit-ins across the country again today. In Lahore, thousands of people continued a three-day-long occupation of a busy square. Omar Farooq reports.
These people are all asking, where's our vote? We went to sleep and the PTI was winning. And we woke up and the PMLN won.
Partial vote results released today reflect that Nawaz Sharif's party, the PMLN, won 125 National Assembly seats. But the protesters here in the square say many more won by ballot stuffing in districts like this one in Lahore. Here and in Karachi, they say they have video evidence showing how workers from rival parties locked themselves inside polling stations and stamped ballots for their own candidates for hours on Saturday. Three PTI protesters were injured in clashes with the police in Khyber Pakhtunkhwa today, and several protesters in Lahore were also injured in clashes 2 days ago. The interim government has agreed to hold a revote in one district of Karachi on May 19th, but these protesters are calling for fresh elections across the city of Karachi and in this district of Lahore. Omar Farooq, FSRN, Lahore.
About 10,000 platinum miners in South Africa are on strike today. The Wildcat walkout follows the weekend death of a union leader who was set to testify at a probe of violence during a strike at the same mine last year. Davison Madzingwa has more from Johannesburg.
All of Lonmin's 13 platinum shafts at the Marikana mine are closed, and the miners are turning down calls to report for duty. The mine is jointly owned by Anglo-American Platinum Limited and the Impala Platinum Holding and is located around 100 miles from the capital, Pretoria. Police killed 34 workers in the Marikana area during strikes last year. The striking workers are affiliated with the Association of Mine Workers and Construction Union, or AMCU. They went on strike as fury over security rises following the assassination of their leader last weekend. The union leader, Mawethu Kulekile Steven, was due to testify at an ongoing probe of last year's deadly strikes at the mine and was the fourth witness to die since December. The tension is complicated by conflict between rival unions, the AMCU, and the National Union of Mine Workers. Some workers demanded the closure of the National Union of Mine Workers' offices. Tefson Mudzingwa, FSRN, Johannesburg, South Africa.
In Canada, a group of Indigenous youth wound up a 1,300-mile-long walk to Ottawa yesterday to protect the country's remaining freshwater lakes. FSRN's Aaron Lakoff has the story.
A group of 15 Native youth, ranging from 13 to 36 years old, left Winnipeg, Manitoba in late March. After walking for almost 7 weeks, they arrived in Canada's capital of Ottawa yesterday. Calling themselves Youth for Lakes, they embarked on their journey to protest Bill C-45, a measure passed late last year that scrapped environmental protections on thousands of lakes and rivers. The group was met in Ottawa by members of the Indigenous Environmental Network and the Idle No More movement, but government officials did not respond to letters requesting meetings. Youth for Lakes is the second Indigenous group to make a long-distance trek to Ottawa in support of the Idle No More movement in the last 2 months, following the Nishiyu Cree marchers who arrived in the city in March. Another group of Mi'kmaq protesters are currently walking from eastern Quebec and are due to arrive in Ottawa next month. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
Minnesota Governor Mark Dayton invited the public to the steps of the Capitol today to bear witness as the state becomes the 12th in the U.S. to grant marriage equality to all of its citizens. The state Senate approved a bill yesterday that will allow same-sex couples to marry beginning in August. Today's signing marks a huge political pendulum swing in the state, where just last November, voters narrowly rejected an amendment that would have banned same-sex marriage. For FSRN, from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. The Associated Press is calling on the Justice Department to explain why it secretly obtained 2 months of records for the office, cell, and home phone lines of AP reporters. The media group is also asking the government to return the records and destroy any copies made, saying they regard the action as a serious interference with AP's constitutional rights to gather and report the news. Other media outlets, civil liberties organizations, and lawmakers are also speaking out against this and other Obama administration actions they say have a chilling effect on whistleblowing and critical investigative reporting. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
Attorneys representing the Associated Press claim they were notified Friday that the Justice Department had been monitoring their private and company phone lines for about 2 months. The AP says the agency violated its own rules in doing so, as they're supposed to notify media outlets before they issue subpoenas for information and negotiate the scope of the demand with them so that it's narrowly tailored to a particular investigation. Trevor Tim with Freedom of the Press agrees, but says the government has a variety of legal tools at its disposal to obtain information.
The Justice Department does not need probable cause whenever they want information like who you're sending emails to, who you're getting them from, same thing with call records, so who you're calling and who's calling you, how frequently they're calling you, what time of day they're calling you. All this information is available with just a subpoena, which a lot of people don't understand. It is incredibly broad. It only has to be relevant to an investigation, and it doesn't need a judge's sign-off, which means they can basically get them for anything.
It's also possible that the information was subpoenaed at the request of a grand jury, which would also bypass the probable cause requirement. The AP says it suspects the Justice Department is investigating who spoke to its reporters for a story published last May that revealed details of an Al-Qaeda airplane bombing plot foiled by CIA agents in Yemen. But they have not confirmed that this is the reason for the investigation. Tim and other privacy and civil liberties advocates say this is another example of the Obama administration's pattern of investigating and prosecuting government employees for revealing information to the press, which has had a profound chilling effect on the media's watchdog function by making government insiders afraid to speak with reporters and vice versa. Attorney Jesselyn Radak with the Government Accountability Project has represented several of these whistleblowers in court.
Is exactly the government's intention to send a message by prosecuting people like Tom Drake and John Kiriakou. Reporters have said it's put a chill on their work. It's put a chill on my work as an attorney. People are reluctant to send anything over email or to make phone calls. And, you know, again, fundamental tenet of the First Community is freedom of the press. It is essential to an open and informed democracy. You know, in the Espionage Act cases against whistleblowers, the government had always been careful to say, oh, don't worry, we're not going after the reporters. But here they are going after the reporters, or at least aggressively making the reporters a part of this leak investigation.
In 5 years, the Obama administration has charged a record 6 government employees under the Espionage Act, and nearly every case has also demanded information from the reporters who published the leaked data. Bernie Lunzer with the Newspaper Guild, the union that represents Associated Press reporters, says these kinds of government actions undermine the ability of the media to do its job.
They need to be able to talk to sources in a way that allows a level of comfort and security. We protect our sources. We think we have a right to. And in this case, what's happening is that the government is undermining that trust. They're creating a really fearful environment, both for journalists, but especially for sources, whistleblowers, whomever, that would want to share information that might be very important to democracy.
The union is now demanding Congress pass stronger protections for reporters, including a measure making the government get a warrant when it wants phone records or other information. Many lawmakers refused to comment on Tuesday on whether such a law is necessary, saying they didn't yet know enough details about this case. But Maryland Democrat Ben Cardin told FSRN that he's troubled by the reports and hopes the Justice Department explains its actions soon.
It's obviously very concerning to see mass information accumulated that looks like there's no reason for. But let me get the facts before I go further than that.
More facts could be forthcoming as the House Judiciary Committee will question Attorney General Eric Holder about the case on Wednesday. Alice Olstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
As proponents of austerity measures continue to push for cuts to social services, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which helps millions of low-income families purchase food, is facing drastic reductions. Today, the Senate Agriculture Committee took up those cuts as it debated the 2013 Farm Bill. The current Senate version of the bill would cut more than $4 billion from food assistance programs over 10 years, while increasing crop insurance subsidies to the nation's largest agribusinesses. Other proposals from House lawmakers seek much higher cuts to food assistance. As lawmakers prepare to vote on the Farm Bill, anti-poverty organizations are advocating to protect the SNAP program. FSRN contributor Anna Simonton has more.
The authors of the Senate Farm Bill propose cutting nearly $4.5 billion from food assistance by changing the rules around a program called the Low-Income Household Energy Assistance Program, or LIHEAP. In some states, people who receive help paying their utility bills through the program are automatically eligible for increased food benefits, a policy known as Heat and Eat. Some senators want to prohibit states from awarding food assistance based on these standards, saying it's a loophole that allows people to receive an increase in food assistance benefits that they may not really need. But rather than preventing people from taking advantage of the system, the Christian nonprofit Bread for the World estimates this provision would result in nearly 500,000 families receiving $90 less in food assistance per month. New York Democrat Kirsten Gillibrand introduced an amendment to revoke the changes to LIHEAP and restore food assistance funding.
Imagine in your own lives what $90 a month pays for. That is a whole week of groceries. And if you're a single mom with 2 kids and working 40 hours a week on our minimum wage, you are earning $3,000 below the poverty line. So imagine what that feels like to have $90 less a month to just feed your kids.
Gillibrand's amendment was tabled during Tuesday's hearing on the bill, but will be up for debate in the full Senate. Meanwhile, the House version of the Farm Bill would enact even deeper cuts to the SNAP program, reducing funding by over $20 billion by changing the eligibility rules for the program. Christine Melendez-Ashley, a policy analyst for Bread for the World, says this could hurt hundreds of thousands of the nation's most vulnerable families.
We estimate about 2 million people would be taken off of the SNAP program completely, even though they are still struggling to put food on the table and to feed their families. And another 280,000, roughly, children would lose access to free school meals because in a lot of places, or across the country actually, if your family is on SNAP, you are eligible for free school meals.
While both versions of the Farm Bill would cut nutrition programs, subsidies for crop insurance would go up by nearly $5 billion in the Senate bill and nearly $9 billion in the House version. Don Carr with Environmental Working Group says this would mainly benefit the country's biggest and most profitable agricultural companies, such as Cargill and Archer Daniels Midland.
What the Senate bill does, unfortunately, is it continues to lavish money on the biggest growers in America of commodity crops like corn and soybeans. And USDA has said repeatedly year after year, we're setting year after year of record farm income for these very same farmers. They're doing quite well. Their operations are getting larger, and they're moving more folks out of rural America through consolidation. And as taxpayers, we're helping bankroll this. We're, as part of our subsidy scheme, we're enabling these operations to get bigger and plow more land. And so that at detriment to the environment and our health, because we're churning out these kind of the raw material for our unhealthy industrial food system.
The full Senate is expected to take up the bill this week. Anna Simonton, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
I'm Ralph Nader. Why do we need Free Speech Radio News? With 200 reporters over six continents giving you the reality of the world, and not taking any corporate money? The answer is in the question. If you really want to learn about what's going on in terms of the brutality around the world, the power of militarism and empire, how people are trying to preserve the planet from climate change to environmental improvement for farmers and consumers and workers, if you want to learn more about what people are really doing to fight back, people who are suffering but not giving up, you will listen to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News cannot exist without your support. That's what makes it honest. The contact for your support, fsrn.org. Let's remember that, fsrn.org. They're waiting for your collaboration.
Today in Los Angeles, media advocates, labor groups, and readers of the Los Angeles Times are rallying downtown to protest the potential sale of the newspaper and its owner, the Tribune Company, to Charles and David Koch. The Koch brothers are billionaires who have funded an array of conservative causes, including efforts to weaken environmental regulation, gun laws, and labor rights, and to promote the privatization of education through state laws and initiatives across the country. The Tribune Company is the second largest media publisher in the United States and owns eight newspapers, including the Chicago Tribune, the Baltimore Sun, the Orlando Sentinel, and the Hartford Courant, and operates 23 television stations. For more, we're joined by Danny Feingold. He's publisher of Frying Pan News, an online publication on the economy. The site has been writing about the possible takeover by the Koch brothers. He's also with the Los Angeles Alliance for a New Economy, one of the groups putting on today's action in L.A. Danny Feingold, welcome to FSRN.
Nice to be with you today.
What are your primary concerns with this potential sale?
I think that the question has been raised about whether the public interest can be well served when two of the most extreme political figures of our time are in control of one of the most important news outlets in the country. And I think a broad range of people, not just on the liberal side, but folks who have a concern for objective journalism, for news-driven journalism, for impartial journalism, all of those issues are at stake here, for not just for Los Angeles, but for journalism on the West Coast and throughout the country.
Well, there are some specific areas where the Koch brothers have had a role either in funding legislative efforts or certain causes. We mentioned a few of them. According to the Center for Media and Democracy, they have funded the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, on some of these, whether it's gun laws, education, environmental regulation. What about these specific areas?
Well, you can really take your choice with the Koch brothers. They have supported a litany of causes that are on the far edges of American political dialogue. If you start simply with their support of the Tea Party, that tells you a lot about who they are, what their ideology is. But you can also look at what the Koch brothers have done, say, on environmental issues. The Kochs and their subsidiaries have poured huge amounts of money into efforts to repeal California's groundbreaking climate change law, into trying to deregulate toxic industrial chemicals, into opening the state's waters to offshore oil drilling. And it's not a coincidence that the Kochs' far-flung business interests in California would benefit enormously from all of these changes.
In addition to media consolidation, labor groups have also raised concern about the Koch brothers' record on labor. In a May 7th letter to Oak Tree Capital, that's the leading shareholder in the Tribune Company, the California Labor Federation said that the Koch brothers have a history of promoting policies that are contrary to the retirement security of working people. What's their record on labor on this issue?
Well, I think voters might recall that it was only 6 months ago that Californians decided to vote down Proposition 32. That was a ballot measure that would have turned over politics in California to a narrow set of very powerful, very rich interests. And the Koch brothers were the primary sponsors of that. Prop 32 was an attack specifically on the ability of unions and people who belong to unions to have a political voice, but it was also an attack on the broader concept of government in California protecting the rights of the majority of residents. And the Koch brothers would be very, very bad news for anybody who cares about basic issues of fairness, equity, and treatment of people in the workplace.
And of course, since it was so newsworthy, there was extensive coverage of Prop 32 in the pages of the Los Angeles Times.
Exactly. And I don't think anyone should be under the illusion, regardless of what the Koch brothers and their representatives might say, that this is simply an investment. Beyond the question of their right-wing agenda, there's a question about journalism in the 21st century and whether or not it serves the public interest to have extremely rich, extremely powerful ideologues in control of a newspaper that still plays a significant role in setting the policy agenda for the largest state in the union.
Well, the Tribune Company extends beyond Los Angeles and California, although the LA Times is the largest paper in that state. The Tribune Company owns the Chicago Tribune, Orlando Sentinel, Hartford Current, Baltimore Sun, and others. Readers and media advocates in some of these cities have also protested this sale. One effort has been what they're calling a local news pledge, which demands that the Tribune Company sell their papers to local owners to ensure independence and diversity of the news outlet. How are efforts in Los Angeles connected to those in other cities?
Well, I think those of us who live in Los Angeles, who care deeply about the city, and people across the country who care about their cities would like to see the ownership of major papers remain local. You need journalistic outlets that are committed to the good of the residents and the cities that they are actually covering. If the Koch brothers take over the Los Angeles Times and all the other Tribune Company's holdings, you're putting a significant number of media outlets in control of two men who have well-established history of extreme politics and, frankly, have a set of economic interests that are not shared by 99.9% of the American population.
Danny Feingold is publisher of Frying Pan News, an online publication on the economy. He joined us from Los Angeles. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Austerity measures implemented by many countries in response to the economic crisis aren't leading to the creation of jobs. New figures from the International Labor Organization estimate that more than 70 million youth are unemployed across the globe. In some countries, including Malawi and Liberia, the rate exceeds 70%. The new figures are nearly as high as the peak of the economic crisis in 2009. UN Radio's Derek Mabatha reports.
The sluggish global economic recovery has been blamed for aggravating the youth job crisis. The International Labour Organization, ILO, says queues for available jobs are becoming longer and longer. The agency points out that despite some regional differences, the global youth unemployment rate continues to rise and is projected to reach 12.8% by 2018. This will wipe out the gains made at the start of the economic recovery. José Manuel Salazar is the ILO's Assistant Director General for Policy.
The global youth unemployment rate decreased from 12.7% in 2009 to 12.3% in 2011, but increased again 12.4% in 2012 and is expected to continue to grow 12.6% in 2013. This is 1.1 percentage points above the pre-crisis level in 2007. In absolute numbers, global youth unemployment is estimated to stand at 73.4 million in 2013, which is an increase of 3.5 million since 2007.
Mr. Salazar says the regional youth unemployment rates showed large variations. He says in 2012, the rates were the highest in the Middle East and North Africa, with 28 and 23% respectively, and the lowest in East Asia and South Asia, where they were just over 9%.
Between 2011 and 12, regional youth unemployment rates increased in six of the nine regions, and these regions are the developed economies and the EU, South Asia, East Asia, the Middle East, North Africa, and Sub-Saharan Africa. This is where regional youth unemployment rates increased. They did not increase in three regions, Central and Southeastern Europe, and the Commonwealth of Independent States, Latin America and the Caribbean, and Southeast Asia and the Pacific.
ILO economist Sarah Elder says education plays a critical role in tackling the problem of youth unemployment. She points out that growth in the economies of developing countries has not translated to good jobs for young people.
The few available good jobs are available only to those who manage to stay in the education system. And these are mostly the young people that benefit from this growing middle class. So if you don't manage to get an education in these economies, then your destiny is very low level, low paid employment in the informal economy. And there's no escape from that.
Moazzam Mahmoud, director of the ILO Economic and Labor Market Analysis Department, says the issue of labor market problems needs to be addressed in tackling youth unemployment.
Policy then comes in very clearly that you've got to address, you've got to walk on two legs. Aggregate demand, you've got to have increased demand for people to want to produce more and to hire more. But there are serious issues in labor markets of rigidities, of principally one of skills mismatch, which need to be addressed.
The ILO stresses that there is no one-size-fits-all solution for youth unemployment. But there are key policy areas to foster pro-employment growth and decent job creation. Derek Mbata, United Nations.
That's it for today's program. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Nell Abram. Our Washington, D.C. editor, Alice Olstein. Our technical production team at KPFA Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. Thanks for listening in Los Angeles. I'm Dorian Marina.